So I just take a few minutes and maybe half an hour to tell you about some idea that's work in progress, which might tell us something about experiments as well. And the idea is that relativistic causality somehow constrains what we can see in interference experiments, even if we do not assume quantum mechanics. So I have two parts. The first part is a bit boring for those who have seen it so many times before. I'll talk a bit about these general probabilistic theories, why we get these strange state spaces, and what about these ball state spaces that appear here. And then there's an actual thought experiment that I'd like to discuss. It's very simple. It's just about a Mach-Zehnder interferometer and the consequences of relativity of simultaneity. Okay, so what is a general probabilistic theory? Yeah, again, I'm probably preaching to the converted and to those who've seen it 1,000 times before. For those who haven't, so a GPT is described by an arbitrary convex state space. And I should say that I'm repeating many things that Howard talked about yesterday, maybe just in a bit of a different language. So why do you get such a thing? So usually what you have in mind, and there's a nice drawing that I copied shamelessly from Lucien's 2001 paper.
Three-dimensional.
Yeah, I made it three-dimensional indeed. And three dimensions have something, they come up later again. So, so you think of a theory where you want to describe something like that, preparation, transformation, and measurement. And the simplest example that you can think of would be a classical coin toss, where your preparation device just means you press a button and then you toss a coin. Maybe you don't see the coin. The transformation device, what it might do is just, you know, rotate the coin by 180 degrees. And then the measurement is very boring. You just look if it's coin, if it's head or tails. And so it has a very simple mathematical description too. You would say, what's the state that comes out? The state is defined by the statistics that you see in the long run. So all you're interested here is the probabilities of seeing heads or tails later on. So your state is exhaustively described by a list of probabilities, probability for heads, probability for tails. And you can talk about the state space, which is just a set of all possible states that you can have. And that would look like this in the case of a coin. So here's like a coin where you know always shows heads, so that coin always shows tails. And in the middle you have fair coin, and then you have the statistical mixtures in between. And in a mathematical sense, this is a line segment, but for later on, you can already note that this is a ball. It's a one-dimensional ball, and we'll see balls again. What are transformations? Well, if you map heads to tails and backwards, then it would just be a linear map that kind of flips these two probabilities. And so in general, transformations, they map states to states because you have an ingoing state, an outgoing state, and they must be linear for many reasons that I can talk about later on if you like. What's a measurement? Well, a measurement has certain outcomes. They all have probabilities, and these probabilities must depend linearly on the state. In this case, it's really simple. If you prepare the state omega with these two entries, p and 1 minus p, and the probability of heads is really just p, and you can formally write that as an inner product with another vector that's sometimes called r. So this is a linear functional on the state. And you will see that the same mathematics applies to the quantum case. For example, if you spin one half particle, then you would say, well, now I don't toss a coin, but I prepare a quantum state, so a superposition of spin up and down. Or more generally, you can think of a mixed state, which is just a density matrix. And then I think you've all seen that you can just, you know, parameterize the state in that way that's on the Bloch ball. So you have two angles, theta and phi, and the pure states then give you a point on this Bloch ball, three-dimensional ball. And the density matrices, the mixed states, are somewhere in the middle here. So that's what the state space looks like for a spin one half particle. The transformations could be unitaries, for example. And in this picture, they just rotate the Bloch ball. And if you measure an arbitrary spin direction, you have a linear functional again on your state, which is not just given by some projection operator in the trace. And you realize that's also a ball, but it's now a three-dimensional ball, whereas classically we had a one-dimensional ball that described basically a bit. This is a qubit now. And the state of all possible states will always be some state space, and it has an important structure. It's convex. And it's convex because you want to describe situations like this here. So thank you for Marius for drawing this. So in physics languages, say when you have an experiment, then there might be fluctuations in your initial conditions. But in this operational language, you say, oh, you have this black box, and you roll a die, and then depending on the outcome, you either prepare state omega 1 or prepare state omega 2. This results in a mixed state, like 1 half omega 1 plus 1 half omega 2. So that's somehow in between these two. And this tells you that whatever that state space is, the line in between two states must also be in there, so it must be a convex set. Quantum theory, this is the set of density matrices. Classical probability theory, it's just a set of probability distributions. And that can be almost anything, so there are really no big constraints on that. I've shown you that the classical coin or bit would be something like that. That's the Bloch ball of quantum mechanics. People have looked at the generalized bit or G bit, which is one half of a PR box, and that would look like a square. It's important to see that like a three-level system in quantum mechanics is not a ball. It looks different. So it looks quite complicated. So that's a picture by a paper by Tsiolkovsky. So it has all these kind of flats on the boundary, which would, for example, be the density matrices that don't have full rank and so on. So it's not very easy to describe. But these things are very easy to describe. So these are the Bloch ball state spaces, and they describe something like a generalized bit in the simplest case. So here again, this is the Bloch ball of quantum mechanics as we know it, quantum mechanics over the complex numbers. This is the classical bit that I've shown you before. And now if you take quantum mechanics and you only allow real entries in the density matrices, you get a pretty good theory as well. And its bit, its qubit, will be described just by a two-dimensional circle state space. But in principle, you can think that you have a higher dimensional Bloch ball where you have more than just Pauli X, Pauli Y, Pauli Z matrices, but just more degrees of freedom that describe your state. And you get this, for example, in quaternionic quantum mechanics, where the density matrices have quaternionic entries, you get a ball again, but it's five-dimensional. And in the octonionic case, it would be a nine-dimensional ball. But in principle, it could be anything. And then all these balls are actually state spaces of Jordan algebras that Howard talked about yesterday. They appear in a way kind of naturally in these axiomatizations. Okay, that was on GPTs. And now let's look at this thought experiment here. So this is joint work with Andy Garner and with Oscar Dahlsten. We're trying to publish that for 2 years now. But okay, so it's a very simple thought experiment. So this is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, the way you know it. So you have an upper branch and a lower branch. And you can think of a particle that's kind of can go both ways. So here the beam splitter, it's kind of decided where it goes. And since it can be up or down, it's a two-level system. It's something like a bit. And so we can think of describing the setup here with just a Bloch sphere state space, like one of the ones we've seen. And this description would mean the following. It would tell you that if you prepare a state at the beam splitter, where you definitely know that the particle will be found in the upper branch, if you look at it, this would correspond to the North Pole state on the Bloch ball. If you're sure you'll find it in the lower branch, that would be the South Pole state of the Bloch ball. And you can also have something like a superposition of the two branches. So that would mean here, for example, if you do a measurement, you find the particle with probability 1/2 here or with probability 1/2 down there. And these would be states, for example, that live on this equator of the Bloch ball. Yeah. And you can put up an axis, call that the z-axis. Then the probability of finding it in the upper branch is related to the z here. It's really just this linear functional. It's 1/2 times z plus 1. So that's the probability of the upper branch here. Okay, now what we can think of is some agents. So maybe there is a physicist, Alice, sitting close to this upper branch, and she can do something to the arm. So you think of, you can just put on like a piece of glass inside the interferometer arm, and this will then be a transformation on your state. You have an ingoing and an outgoing state, and you can ask what kinds of transformations could this be? Well, so first of all, if we want that it's reversible and then we can run it backwards in principle, then it should just preserve the Bloch ball. So it should map the Bloch ball to itself, which is basically a rotation of the Bloch ball. So the effect must be a rotation of this Bloch ball. And we also know something else, namely, if you do it only here, then you will not move the particle downwards or upwards. So the probability of finding it in the upper arm doesn't change. That's just preserved, which means that the z-axis here must be preserved because that gives you the probability. And so you know it's not just some rotation, but actually one maybe like that along the equator, which preserves this rotation axis. Yeah.
Is the assumption you're using there based on no signaling? Okay. Can you show that if you could change those probabilities, then you could signal?
More or less, I would say so. So the thing is that, I mean, intuitively, you would model that differently. You would say there's a circuit, and it's a tensor product state space. Maybe the upper arm is A, and then tensor B, it's a bipartite state space. And then no signaling tells you that the transformations must commute to something. But here it's in a different framework. You would say this is a two-level system now, and then you have to put in no signaling by hand. Yeah. But it's true, if you could change the probability just by acting in one arm, then you could see that in the other arm. And if they are far away, then you could probably use that to send information. Yeah. So yeah, I guess it's no signaling. Yeah.
I've got a little confused about the labeling, because it seems like you have 4 qubits worth of degree of freedom for the particle, whichever arm it's traveling on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And initially those are correlated with being up or down, but that's mm-hmm. but that's an extra degree of freedom, the position one. So it's not clear what's wrong with a general unitary on the up thing. You could still reverse it, and it would still be in the up path. You can say more about that. Or
you mean you could imagine doing some arbitrary unitary if that's a Bloch ball, but it would mean that you have to kind of apply it on both arms separately. You bring the arms back together.
I think there's only one Bloch ball for the whole thing. Right?
There's one Bloch ball for the whole thing.
It's not one separate one for the upper arm and one separate for the lower arm.
So it's a two-dimensional Hilbert space, really. It's spanned by up and down as two basis states.
No. Okay, so I shouldn't think of it as something like you measure or split the z eigenstates plus or minus a half, and the plus half one went up and the minus half went down. That's not what's going on here.
Well, I think that is what's going on. So if, you know, these are your two eigenstates, and one of the eigenstates does describe being in the upper arm. The other one does describe being in the lower arm. So that's true.
I think Adrian was thinking that there were 2 degrees of freedom, like a spin degree of freedom and a spatial degree of freedom.
Oh, okay.
And that they were becoming entangled like they do in a Stern-Gerlach.
Yes.
And that's not what's going on.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's not what's going on. There's no polarization degree of freedom or anything like that. Okay. Really just the position now.
Okay. Yeah. Marcus, one other question. If you want to extend this analysis to other kinds of two-level systems, like a two-level atom, this assumption you've made about the probabilities of the two eigenstates not changing under this local phase change, it might not port to those other scenarios. Like, we're, you know, if this is really a no-signaling assumption.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, is the claim that this is going to be generic for two-level systems or just for interferometers?
So what you can do is you can build a much more general framework, and that's what Andy Garner did and Oskar Dahlsten, where you just say this could describe anything. There could be more arms. You could also have more degrees of freedom, like polarization. But then when you say I do it locally in one arm, then this is a claim about a certain measurement outcome probability not changing. Yeah. If you do it in one arm, then the outcome probability of finding it in that arm doesn't change. And then you can look at all transformations that are compatible with that. And that's what they call the phase group. And it has, in general, a much more difficult, complicated structure than in the simple example. It may be much bigger than just being a phase here, but if you have other degrees of freedom, you can rotate your polarization locally and so on. So, yeah. Yeah, so you can generalize that, but this is like the simplest situation where you can say most in a way. Not sure if that answers your question.
Let me see if I've understood it. In a more general two-level system, instead of talking about, say, local transformations on one branch, because you don't have branches, you might just have two-level atom or whatever.
It sounds to me like you're saying
I could still define the set of operations which don't change the relative probabilities of two states.
Right, yeah.
And then we just talk about those. So we sort of put it in by definition.
Yeah. In, that way. In a way, it's the space-like separation here that you assume that motivates that you don't change this probability.
Okay.
But if you don't have the space-like separation, then yeah, I agree. You could do other things. And indeed, in a Machzine interferometer, that's what you do. You put in an e to the I phi, some phase, that doesn't change these probabilities.
Are we still doing quantum mechanics, or are we supposed to think of this as an arbitrary system?
Yeah, in the simplest case, you can think of that as the three-dimensional Bloch ball, then it's just standard two-level quantum mechanics. But this could be the quaternionic Bloch ball, where you have quaternionic phases, something like that. But it's a Bloch ball, so it's still close to quantum mechanics. Yeah. Next step is to think of actually having two different agents that decide locally what they want to do. So maybe if L is sitting close to the upper arm and Bob being close to the lower arm, and they both decide independently what kind of piece of glass they want to put in the arm of the interferometer. And now what about this? So for the moment, let me make a very strong assumption. So let's assume for now, and I will relax that in a bit, that what you can do here in the upper arm, the group of things that you can do here in the upper arm, and the group of things that you can do in the lower arm, these are all the transformations that you can think of which preserve this axis. So I told you whatever you do here, it always has to preserve this axis. Let's now assume for a second that there are no further constraints. You can do all these transformations. And the transformations that preserve this axis in d dimensions is just the rotations in one dimension less. So that will be SOD minus one. These are the group of transformations that you can do locally. Yeah. Think of SO2 in quantum mechanics, which is just the complex phase. To stretch a bit further, think you're flying by in a spaceship, yeah, with very high speeds in different directions. So if you fly by in a spaceship in one direction, then these might be your lines of simultaneity. And you actually see TA happening first, and then you see the space-like separated transformation TB happening. Whereas your friend in the other spaceship might see it the other way around. Yeah.
Very good. You said this could be quaternionic or something like that, or real or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what happens in the real case. Maybe not much.
Yeah.
But in the quaternion case, is it true that by independent interventions, A and B, you can rotate it arbitrarily, SO4 or whatever it is?
So in principle, yes. Yeah. If you just forget relativity for now, say if this two-level system, you want to preserve this Z probability, then you have SO4.
Right, but I mean, is there some actual model of what is? And I can imagine putting in a piece of glass, that's just one phase. So two pieces of glass is only at most 2 degrees of freedom. So are there actual sort of models of quaternionic pieces of glass?
I hope some other people can say something about that, experimentalists, because there's Paris experiment that suggests to do something like that. And I don't know the answer. There's also a book on quaternionic quantum mechanics by Adler, but I never read it, so I don't know what he would say about it. But a priori, there's no physical model really there to concretely say what that particle would be. Okay, so in relativity, you can think of just two reference frames. So in one reference frame, since they're space-like separated, it's TA that happens first and then happens TB. Whereas in the other reference frame, it's the other way around. And now what you want to have is that the detector clicks that you might gather in the end here, their probabilities should be independent of the reference frame. So whatever state comes out in the end and whatever measurement you do with it shouldn't depend on the reference frame. And this can only be if the order doesn't matter. So if TA TB is the same as TB TA. And now if you assume that that's true for all these transformations, then this group here must be commutative. So SOD minus one must be a commutative group. But we know that rotations commute only in two dimensions and not in higher dimensions. So D minus one can be maybe two, but not higher. So you see that the dimension of the Bloch ball must be three or less under these assumptions. Yeah. If it's two, as you asked for in the real case, it would be very boring. All you could do is basically the identity maps over here. And maybe a flip, like a minus one or something. Should be a pretty boring world. So that's kind of an argument why the Bloch ball should be three-dimensional. And I can ask, well, that's a strong assumption that I can actually do all these transformations in both arms. Let's weaken this assumption. And then you can play a game and try to weaken the assumptions. And for example, instead of saying that you can do exactly the same thing in both arms, you can just say that both are isomorphic groups. So whatever you do in one arm has a description that's similar to what you do in the other arm. And if you do that, then suddenly you also can get D equal to 5. So you still can get quaternionic quantum mechanics. But you cannot get any higher dimensional Bloch balls. And you can, you know, write down a theorem under some assumptions that classifies the possibilities that you can have. And depending on the exact assumptions that you make, and we're still trying to find out what the best formulation is, you basically get that the Bloch bound must be anything between dimension 2 and 5, but not higher. And you can also distinguish experimentally the situation of the complex with the quaternionic quantum bit operationally. So in the complex quantum bit, I said that the groups that you can, whatever you can do here, is just the same group as down there. So what does it mean? Well, it means that whatever transformation Alice does can be completely undone and reversed by something that Bob does. Yeah. So for example, if you put in a phase plate in the arm A, you can just put in the same phase plate in B, and then nothing, in effect, nothing happens. And that's what I mean by this here. Yeah. And now what about quaternionic quantum theory, where these are just isomorphic groups? Well, you could say, here's a phase plate. There's an analogous phase plate, something similar down there. But I cannot, in general, reverse what Alice has done in Bob's arm. So basically, it turns out, if I remember correctly, I hope that was SU2. Somehow in the quaternionic case, what you can do is like SO4 rotations in the arm, and Alice can do the left isoclinic and Bob the right isoclinic rotations. That's somehow two groups from which SO4 is composed, and they don't talk to each other. Good. Now, why is that interesting? I think here, I guess it actually has to say something about interference experiments. So there's this Paris proposal that also Thomas talked about. And Paris suggests to do something very much along the lines that I've sketched here. He proposes to, like, you know, actually distinguish somehow complex from quaternionic quantum mechanics. And then Gregor Weiss also talks about doing this. And in his slides, he mentions you want to do a generalized Paris test where you have two interferometer arms and you want to distinguish complex from quaternionic or maybe even octonionic quantum mechanics. And according to what I've shown you, I guess the bets are pretty bad for octonionic quantum mechanics. Yeah. Just because from the geometry of the setup, you wouldn't expect to be able to probe these octonionic degrees of freedom from relativity of simultaneity. Then there's these ones, the higher order interference experiments. I don't know why I put the picture here, but anyway, so all this suggests is kind of a well-informed speculation. So the question I want to raise here is somehow whether the interference pattern, not only in this Mach-Zehnder interferometer, but maybe also in a free slit experiment, is somehow constrained by relativistic causality as well. May this be the case? And maybe this is the reason why we only see second order interference. It's very speculative. But if so, then maybe this suggests that we should build experiments where the interferometer arms are not really space-like separated, so that we don't get into these constraints that come from relativistic causality. But maybe, on the other hand, maybe it's even useful because we're also talking about a device-independent implementation of projections and of slits. I'm sure we make projections. And one thing we know about projections is that they commute for different outcomes. And maybe by doing them space-like separated way, you can kind of enforce that they must commute, even if you don't assume quantum mechanics. So it might actually also help us in a way. So that's of course very speculative at the moment. I would say we should just look and see what relativity tells us in the setup. But the fact that you found SO2 here is very related to the path integral. So I think it's there. So this kind of dq, and then you have e to the I s of q, that you build this path integral when you have all these different possible paths. That has, of course, to do with this fact here, that somehow you can imagine doing something on the different paths. And since they almost commute, it can possibly be only be an element of SO2. And that's an element of SO2. And the fact that we expect only second order interference has to do with this thing, but also with the Born rule in addition. So the idea would be study what kinds of behaviors we could expect to see under these constraints that come from relativistic causality. Yeah. Okay, so thanks.
Your argument regarding the interferometer, how to get d is equal to 3. So you said, imagine that we can do every operation that preserves the probabilities of being found on a given path or another.
Yeah.
And that seems to do a lot of work in group, because if I had, SOD for some large D, the actual subgroup SOD minus one was implementable, but just not in this architecture. I just couldn't do it with these local operations. It was still possible. Then, of course, I could have all these other theories. So I'm just wondering, is there something you can say that would justify that strong assumption?
Yes. So, So first, I should say that this assumption is weakened later on, but in a way, what you can never really exclude is that, actually this two-level system is described by like a 50-dimensional ball, but 47 of the dimensions never enter this experiment. I just don't see them. They're kind of inaccessible by whatever I do here.
Right.
And there's no way to ever rule that out. So somehow you must put in some kind of assumption that tells you that you restrict yourself to those things that you can really do in this experiment. And you might not want to formulate it in that way, but you might want to say, well, let's look at the group of things that's generated by whatever I can do locally. Mm-hmm. And only look at the subspace of state space that I can explore by doing this.
So the way it has the same flavor of a local tomography assumption, it's saying, things I can do locally actually exhaust the things that could be done in principle to some extent.
Yeah. And I was thinking whether this is more than just, whether there's a formal relation. When you formulate it in the way you say this is kind of 0 tensor 1 plus 1 tensor 0, when you just say this is actually two Hilbert spaces, a tensor product Hilbert space, and then have an entangled state, that's another way to model it.
Right.
Then you can also have local tomography. And maybe that's in fact related, but I'm not quite sure about that.
It would still be a bit different from local tomography if you're saying something like a unitary on A can be simulated by a unitary on B for these maximally entangled states.
Yeah, even though here in the quaternionic case it's a bit more subtle. Well, I'm going backwards. So here, you cannot really simulate what you do in one half with the other half. It's just that there's an analog, like there's a counterpart of everything you do on one arm in the other arm, in the other half. But if you compose these things that you can do here, it kind of exhausts, in this case, all of SO4, and thus of this five-dimensional Bloch ball. So, yeah. But yeah, it's not quite clear what assumptions to put here in detail, but you have to have some kind of assumption that throws away invisible degrees of freedom somehow.
Well, this is similar. I'm confused by exactly the same thing. I mean, suppose it was just ordinary quantum mechanics, but say they were qubits. I mean, suppose you had spin or have an internal degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then it wouldn't be true that every operation you can do is just a tensor product of some operation on the upper arm and on the lower arm.
Yeah.
So, and then you say so that's too strong an assumption in general. Then you say you've weakened it, but I didn't so the ultimate result is under the weakened assumption, is that right? Or, I mean, what's the, two questions. First, how do we know how much to weaken it? I mean, do you agree with what I just said? First of all?
I agree,
okay,
yeah.
And then how much do we know how to weaken it physically, and also maybe you can just explain what the weakened assumption was, because went by a little too quickly.
So I have to remember now what we had in the end, but I guess one assumption was somehow in this Bloch ball picture. So yeah, so I should say this is like the first starting point we're going to look at. It's very simple with strong assumptions. So one thing we assumed was you have this set axis, which somehow tells you the probability of being in one arm or the other. And you say this is decided on the beam splitter. So the beam splitter decides the probability of the upper arm. And then you say, let's now look at all that I can do locally. And let's take whatever I can do if I just, maybe you do something here, then over there, then again in Alice's arm, then again in Bob's arm, the group that's generated by that. And we assume that this gives you the whole equatorial, exhausts all the state space where the probability is fixed. This is like this equator here. And there might be other states, but you cannot access them here, and you don't have to take them into account. That's basically the assumption. So there's a kind of transitivity property. Whatever you have on the equator, you can somehow get it by composing local operations. And I haven't thought enough, I think, about how what happens if you have other degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but if there was
yeah. Then... yeah, yeah. I just don't know. Like, one should look at that for sure, yeah.
I've tried running through this argument for a hypercube state space. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that when you have a separation along one axis for your states, one goes in one arm and the other, mm-hmm. then the kind of operations that you could perform, which would leave those invariant, are translations in the other dimensions of the hypercube. So you have
the
bottom, then you can move left, right. Mm-hmm. And all the translations in all the other dimensions do commute. So therefore, it seems like there would not be any kind of argument to limit the dimension of a hypercube state space.
So you mean like really like a cube in d dimensions?
Yeah.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's okay, I mean you could say the lower area is somehow something where you know the particle is in the lower branch and the upper one would be, you know, in the upper branch. And then
what are the transformations in your case?
So if we think about a cube, so one notion of orthogonal states, which are perfectly distinguishable, would be, say, the origin and just one above the origin. And so those could be the two states which would initially go into the interferometer, and then you could form...
Where is the origin? The
origin is sort of like the lower left.
The lower left.
And so then...
this one?
Yeah.
And now this?
So that would be with an upper state and then...
up. Like, and then somewhere here?
Well, no, adjacent to it, but just perfectly distinguishable, so...
Okay, like...
here. The sort of down state.
Oh, this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you could, you know, split those.
Yeah.
And then you could translate along the other two dimensions with those translations here.
Well, you have... Okay, I mean, here it's just an assumption that we have this Bloch ball because it comes out naturally in many of his axiomatizations. But if you do that and you want to reverse all the transformation, you still have to preserve the cube. You cannot like move the cube around, but you can just rotate it by 90 degrees. So basically, if this is the d-dimensional cube and then you preserve these two things, then you have the symmetry group of this d minus one dimensional thing, which is just... And if D is too large, then the symmetry group may also not be a commutative group.
Right.
And if you assume you can do it in both arms, then you run into the same argument, I think.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Good. We should. Okay. Sorry.
So I wondered the business of assuming that you can undo the transformation on the A wing from the B wing. So that, I think that was your starting assumption before you moved on to the octagonal case,
yeah.
You weakened it.
Yeah.
So are you familiar with the Zurek's derivation of the Born rule using environment-assisted invariance?
Mm.
Because that's,
I read about it a long time ago, but I don't really remember.
So if you represent this in the second quantized picture, like you were saying, so that it's an entangled state, and then you say, okay, well, the unitary on system A can be undone by the unitarian system B.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much precisely what his assumption is.
Oh, okay.
He calls environment assisted invariance.
Ah, okay.
And so it'd just be interesting to see whether there's any connection.
Right. It's this N variance paper that he wrote. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's also an experiment that we did with IGC
to test whether you can, in fact,
whether
restore
the instrument was a bound on the 2 factor, but then it was like 2.003 years. I don't even know if it was 2-3 years ago that this, but with Kevin.
You mean the exponent and the Born rule?
Yeah. So we derived it from the experimental result. Because, as you said, that Born rule can be derived from invariance. So then we actually did an experiment to test invariance.
Uh-huh.
And then use that experimental result to derive a bound. But then, unfortunately, it was 2 million the errors. So it was something like 2.001 plus or minus 0.0. I don't quote me because I don't remember the exact number. It was a couple of years ago. But it was 2 million the error. That was the
question.
Huh. What was the test? Or do you remember the details?
Yeah, so it was a photon, entangled photon source. And so then, as he said, so it was basically half wave plates. And so on one arm, we did an operation, and the other one, we kind of did the. And so then, and then we sort of did tomography and bell basis measurements, found the fidelity to those, and came up with the conclusion that invariance has been tested up to 99.99%. And Born rule was also kind of.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
I wonder, when I think about this kind of assumption, I have a conceptual justification in mind, and I wonder if it's the same as yours, which is that your SOD minus 1 degrees of freedom could be thought of as somehow relational degrees
exactly,
of freedom.
Yeah.
And consequently, I ought to be able to change relational degrees of freedom completely by just doing local actions either on side A or on side B.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you think about it?
That's exactly how I think about it, yeah. And I think this is a good point here, too. Because if you write out the path integral, then actually you don't get this here. This is a fictitious quantity. But you get the absolute square. And if you write it up, then you have just this thing. I mean, you all know that, I'm sure. And so basically this tells you that whatever enters is just the relation between two baths, and the relation is exactly the difference in the phase shift. And it's a relation only between pairs of paths, and of the kind that you see in this thought experiment. So I tried to think about the question if we have triples of paths, how they could actually be related in a triple kind of way.
Yeah.
How you would actually formalize this kind of relational behavior, but I don't know.
So how do you respond? Say, imagine a skeptic who says, I think the right theory is a 50-dimensional ball.
Mm.
And 47 of those dimensions aren't relevant to that experiment because I think that of those 49 dimensions, only 2 of them are about relational properties and the other 47 are about holistic properties. And that's why you can't manipulate them in this way.
Yeah.
And that's why your argument for abelian groups doesn't go through.
Yeah.
Like what's?
I would love that because it would kind of tell us that maybe actually nature is much bigger than what we see. Maybe there are these bigger state spaces really out there, but here's a reason why we typically don't see them. Because that's usually what we probe, is these kinds of degrees of freedom. Just by the way we build our experiments, that would be nice. That would be like the idea or great result you could have in the end, maybe, we say, just by the way that we do our experiments in Minkowski space, typically, has as a consequence that we see many things that look like quantum theory, even though we might have all these other things around that are not quantum.
I see, so we've blinded ourselves to the holistic properties.
The way we act here washes out all these other degrees of freedom and we only see the ones that where we act locally. Or nature acts locally by the action function or something. I'm just speculating, right? Very speculative.
And this, you raise really a more general question, which is, which I think is a very interesting and important question, although I would myself, as usual, describe it in a more history's language. But it's what is the constraint on the path integral, or feel in your language, I think, what are the constraints on the transformation that express relativistic causality? Is there some intrinsic way? I mean, here you, as usual, related it to interventions by external agents, and then that, along with that goes the idea that relativistic causality is expressed by no signaling. Mm-hmm. But is there something in the structure of the fact? I mean, this is what you're, this is, you've given us a special case, mm-hmm. irrespective of the details, whether we agree with every step or every assumption. It's showing us how we could get intrinsic constraints on the possible transformations from relativistic causality. Yeah. The question is, what are there, is there a more general kind of derivation or argumentation along these lines? In the case of, say, relativistic quantum field theory, people sort of think they know what it is, but it's not in the same framework. It's in a very special, I suppose most people think, even this I don't know, but my impression is that everyone doesn't agree, but they all agree that relativistic causality is exhausted by two things, the commutativity at space-like separations, or anti-commutativity in the case of fermion fields, and the globally hyperbolic, or the hyper. What's the right word? The hyperbolic character of the field equation, meaning, you know, that in effect they have their differential equations that don't propagate information outside the lifetime. Actually, I don't know. Some people seem to just focus on one and forget the other, and other people focus on the other. I don't know if there's actually a consensus about which one, if either, is dispensable, but certainly those are the two that I know that people. Does anyone know about this? Anyway, yeah, those are the two, but they're all in the a very specific framework of sort of Poincaré invariant, usually in fact.
Yeah, but yes, you want quantum mechanics.
I mean, it's all within quantum mechanics, but. Is there a hint here? I mean, there's a hint here, but you know how to pursue the hint to get something more.
I wish I knew it better. Yeah, but this just started, and hope there's something else to discover. It would be nice.
Okay. But for path integrals, there is also, in the path integral formulation, there are ideas for this too, but again.
Yeah. I mean.
Not complete.
Ideally, we would have a theorem that the path integral is a unique possibility in relativistic causality or something like that. But
well, that's another thing. But then, but suppose you accept that you do have a path integral. Mm-hmm. It's not every path integral will be free of these superluminal effects.
Right.
So the question is, what is it about the path integral itself? What is it about the amplitudes that go into it?
Yeah.
In the language I was using yesterday, what is it about the decoherence functional or the quantum measure that tells you that the kind of causality involved is compatible with relativity?
So maybe we should go on discussing downstairs at the coffee break. So, yeah, thanks for listening.